This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
I'm your inner dream monologue, and you're fast asleep, so I'll be quick. Great job using the Colgate Optic White Overnight Teeth Whitening Pen before bed. When used as directed, it gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 7 days. So while I fly and talk to animals, you're removing teeth stains with ease. Sweet dreams. And when you wake up, keep on living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
Standard issue for all women.
Welcome to this week's Sunday Chops. And if you've just got up, welcome to Sunday. It's going to be a bit less sweaty than last Sunday, I understand, slash hope. And the good news keeps coming, because this week I've a real treat of a Chops for you, in which I talk to actor, comedian and writer Dhu McKeachan, whose incredibly to-the-point memoir, My Lady Parts, is coming to a bookstore near you. We chat about, well, just about everything you'd expect. Smack the pony, pedo-geddon, and how Dune's unafraid to say what she thinks, and how incredibly refreshing that is. As the saying goes, never meet your idols. I'm guessing the person who said that never met Dhu McKeachan, because she's fucking great. Hope you enjoy it. Until next week.
Dhu McKeachan, welcome to Standard Issue.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here. Well, to be on a phone talking to you somewhere with all sorts of technical things that I don't understand, but great.
Yeah.
It's only my second ever podcast, so that's rather wonderful, isn't it?
I said this to you the other day when we were on the phone. I'm going to say it again. I absolutely loved your book. There is not an inch of fat on it. I quoted Eleanor Roosevelt at you. I might as well do it again. The advice she gave for public speaking is know what you want to say, say it, sit down again. And I feel like you've really embraced that spirit in your book. Did you enjoy writing it?
That's such a lovely thing to say, because the hardest bit was cutting it down from, so it's about half the size it was. So that's interesting. And I really needed that very strong editorial helicopter over me, because I couldn't, it's very hard to cut your own stories when they're true.
Yeah.
I suppose it might be easier if it was fiction and someone went, oh, I don't like that subplot, or I'm not sure about that character. But you can't really say that about someone's life. She was only able to say this doesn't fit into what we're trying to do here. So I never started off wanting it to be printed, which is interesting. I just started writing in lockdown because I was locked down with my young teenage daughter, and it was so hard for her to be just learning online day after day, these droning voices. It was just so depressing for her. My job was to kind of keep interrupting and saying, do you want pancakes, or should we have a coffee, or just kind of break up the day. And I thought, I've got to be in, you know, I'm such an outdoor bird. I found it really hard not to be out swimming and walking. And so I just recently moved. I found a stack of diaries. I thought, wow, wouldn't it be interesting to write the arc of my story? So I just started for myself, and then realised there were a few stories that I really thought needed to be shared. Got in touch with an old friend who was an agent, and sent her like two chapters. She encouraged me to keep going, so I did. Yeah.
Now, you strike me from reading this as a woman who absolutely speaks her mind. I wondered, at what point in your life, now you've had the chance to be looking back over it because you're writing a memoir, at what point in your life do you think that you first felt truly comfortable with doing that?
I mean, that's a very good question. That's a million-dollar question, particularly for women, to be able to speak up when we're not feeling confident in a room, or we see some injustice and we're like, oh, I better not say. I mean, I was very quiet at uni. I found everyone quite erudite. I felt I didn't really speak up at uni, but instead I spoke through my first stand-up there. I was able to see quite ballsy characters through the people I was playing, through the monologues I was doing. So I suppose I was speaking my mind through my art. To actually stand up to people, well, after university, I've got to, how old was I? In my early 20s, in Brixton, doing stand-up. Oh, gosh, just finding my way in my 20s and then starting to actually, as you read the book, you'll realise that I do, you know, refuse to do certain things like shave my legs or get naked or be certain stereotypes. So I don't want to play that character. I want to play somebody with a bit more, you know, complicated, messy femaleness. So probably, I wasn't forthright, say, within a rehearsal room, probably till I was in, probably when I had my first child, I became, yeah, like an animal. Like I got to A, look after my children, and B, I've got to make money, and C, what are you fucking talking about? I'm not going to do that. And where are my children going to go? So I became a bit more ballsy because it was so unfair. There was nowhere for the kids to go. There was no money for them. It was like, how am I going to work and have children? So that was that's probably when I started to be a bit more mouthy. Yeah.
I mean, you do a phenomenally mouthy thing in your book that I was incredibly impressed by, because I listeners will know this. I bloody love David Mamet. I think he's an absolute giant of theatre. However, I don't know how much time I could spend with him as a human being. And I think he'd probably be quite scary. You, however, wrote him a letter and told him what was what, which I was really impressed with.
Yeah. He had written me a kind of fan letter. And so I had his address on the back of this envelope. And by the end of the rehearsals and the production and the fact that he'd really shouted at one of our lovely stage managers and, you know, upset a lot of people and fired people, I just thought, oh, do you know what? This is not... And he left the day we opened, he went back to America. So we weren't going to see him again.
I
sat down at my desk, my little Jane Austen desk, with a pen and paper, and I wrote him, a letter cataloguing his misdemeanours. The fact that, you know, I wasn't paid nearly enough. Obviously, I'm working with Malkovich, so he's going to get the pot. I understand that. I'm not an idiot, but I just sort of catalogued. I said, if I was a banker in a city and you'd give me a bonus because I've come out of this show $7,000 down. I just felt quite angry about the economics of it, but also how he was in the rehearsal room. But in the rehearsal room, I definitely stood up for him in a way that people always kind of look at me. I become the spokesperson for, you know, the group. So if we've got an arsey person, everyone's like, dude, you need to say something. So it's a bit mean, actually. I'm the one sent to the front of the class to take down the teacher, or because I'm not really afraid to do that. Yeah, and I also love Mamet and studied him at uni. But, you know, once he knew I was going to stand up to him, he didn't get out of hand. But he was a bully with some of the younger people, and that was very upsetting. So it's also trying to sort of show them that that's not okay as well within a rehearsal room, which needs to be very trusting and needs to build people up so that they give their best. So I just had to do it. And then I posted it and I felt great. And then I got a reply from him. So, you know, there we go. It's worth taking on the big ones and the bullies as well.
Well, talking of taking on the big ones, now I want to talk to you about the National Theatre, because there's a cliche in journalism about asking working women about how they mix working life and motherhood. And I understand that a lot of women have said over the years, can you stop asking me it? Because they don't ask the same question of men, obviously. But interestingly, given lots of women were asked that question, I still think that the answers that they gave weren't getting printed in their full entirety, because you tell a story in this about the National Theatre and how the National Theatre still has no creche, basically, for anyone that's working there. And I just think maybe we should go back to asking women more questions about how they work, because this problem's still not solved, is it, for a lot of women in the entertainment industry?
I agree. This is not a question that on any level should be silenced, because even just about 3 weeks ago, I was finishing a BBC sitcom and one of the lovely, you know, costume ladies who've been on it for years had had a baby against all the odds and had had a very difficult time and wanted to bring her baby in and did. And then there was a huge, huge email. I mean, just to bring in to say hi to everyone, not like to have the baby in all the time.
Yeah.
Just to say hi so they could meet this beautiful child. Huge long email, you know, the next day, basically banning children under 18 from the set.
Wow.
So that's got to be taken. I'm taking that on with the producer. Is that just children of the technical people or is that children of the actors? And, you know, there was another woman in the show who has a kid who never would even dare to ask to bring her child in. Now, that's terrible because basically what you're doing is you're penalising women. You're saying you can't bring your baby onto set, so you can't breastfeed.
Mm.
It's just very much in the dark ages and very much questions that need to be constantly asked because we often are the ones, your husband might be doing half the week or whatever, but for half the week or for some of the time, you're going to want to see your kids.
Mm.
Or you decide, actually, I'm not going to see my kid for 3 months. So, you know, it's your decision as an actor what to do. But it's very unfair. And it's actually... it's very penalising to women, I think, particularly to say ban children from the set,
yeah.
Which I've never heard. You don't want kids running around because it's all health and safety and stuff. But, you know, my kids have come to set since they were, because I've been belligerent about it and gone, where can I put the kids? Where can they be? And people are like, oh, I don't, well, there's a, you know, I'm not sure. And then you have to get your agent on board and then they have to take that on for you. So I suppose you have to have an agent who is going to be on your side about fighting for A, money for childcare, and B, if you want to bring them with you, where are they going to go? You need a bigger space. You normally have a tiny little caravan with a little sofa in it, and if you're bringing a baby and a nanny with you, you need more space. It's really still in the dark ages, isn't it? We're not sorted. And they're talking, I think, on film sets about having mobile creches. They've been talking about that for years. It's never happened. I've never heard of one. It would take an A-lister to go, I'm going to say, here's a bus, and let anyone who's got kids bring it in, and we'll hire nannies and et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it becomes increasingly hard to work and for your children.
Yeah. In this book, you are a lot of things that we are traditionally told that women shouldn't be, and I think that's brilliant. You are argumentative, you're difficult, you show a lot of sides. I found it really, really refreshing. For example, women aren't supposed to be proud, you know, of the things that they've done, and you are very, very proud of the things you've done, in particular Smack the Pony, because it did change the comedy industry, and I don't think you should be afraid to say that. In fact, I think you should say it all the time. How do you feel about that time now, looking back at it, other than very proud?
The Smack the Pony time.
Yeah,
I feel sad that there's not more shows like it around. I mean, there are definitely women coming through. There are some great female-led shows, but not as many as I would have hoped. I sort of thought, this is great. We didn't think it was going to work. It did work. We thought it was terrible. Nobody laughed. The all-male crew just looked really bored. We thought, this is a disaster. And then, you know, with the packaging and with the continued good writing, with the fact that we just were in charge of a lot of the writing ourselves, we were able to write from our experiences, very much from the female experience. Yeah, I'm just proud of the show, that because it's still watched by so many young people, and so many people who've gone into the business have gone into the business because of it. That's an amazing feeling. You know, working with directors, young directors, 25, 26-year-olds, who started because they started watching Smack the Pony. It's a brilliant feeling because, again, in it, women are doing what they're not meant to be doing, you know, being sexually voracious or falling over or looking ugly or just being clownish, just being not good and not quiet. It broke lots of molds, and that's very good for women to continually break out of where we've been put and silenced for so many years and still are. But it's really great to have broken out of that within Smack. And that's why I think people still love it, because it's so full of mischief and anarchy, really.
We have Fiona Allen on the podcast, actually, this week. And
great.
Mickey talked to her quite a lot about, how silly and daft it was. And, I just love a bit of daft, I have to say. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's not we don't have a history of being clowns, for a start. So the thing I mentioned in the book, you know, Sally's sucking a glass onto her face in a pub and Fiona's telling her about an awful breakup, and then she can't get the glass off. And, you know, that silliness is really funny. It looks at female friendships, and we're not just talking about men, and we're not seen in relation to men, and we're not being bitches, which is a huge thing.
Yeah.
Because men often write women as bitches. Very competitive. We're competitive in really silly ways, like with songs or something, or drinking water, but not like, oh, you look nice, you know, what's that you're wearing? You know, the way women are set up against each other is not natural, and we're not like that. So we were being very honest about how women, you know, communicate, which was just joyful.
Yeah. Now, talking of honest, you've an incredible chapter in your book about your son's battle with leukemia. It's a really great bit of writing, and that is really honest. And you are showing a number of sides there that women aren't supposed to show at all, which is, you know, what we might call our ugly side, you know, angry, irrational. And I think it's a tremendous piece of writing.
Thank you.
How did you feel about revealing that part of yourself?
Again, I wasn't going to write about Louis because it's so private and so painful. But sort of 2 years after it, it was nearly 2 years after he was in remission. I just felt, I probably did have post-traumatic stress, you know, knowing what that is now.
Yeah.
I sadly, you know, divorced. I was a single mum. I was struggling with work and money. And I just thought, I've got to write this. I've got to make sense of what this period means in my life.
Mm.
I wrote a little bit of it and sent it to a friend. And she went, you need to write this. I just wrote a tiny bit about what it was like walking into the hospital for the first time. So, yeah, then I managed to get the notes from the hospital, which was really hard because they don't give out the notes because people want to sue them because their kids have died. But because we'd had such a close relationship with them, we'd built a garden there and raised a lot of money, and they did give me the notes. And then I came through the notes, I was like, how am I going to put this into a... I decided it should be a one-woman show about Louis, because people can understand what he'd gone through. So it became about it representing him so that people could put their problems in perspective and go, the way this kid dealt with his illness was so inspiring and brave. I want to pass this on to anyone who's moaning about their loft conversion or their sore foot or their, I don't know, it just became like you need to see what pain is and what this kid has done.
Yeah.
I was so incredibly in awe of how he's been throughout the process. So, yeah, so I started writing it, and it took ages because I started, as I say in the book, I got a lovely director and we started working on it, and he couldn't cut it. It was too painful and too near the knuckle. So we postponed it for another year. I got a dramatist on board to help me. So it was a kind of long process. And then when it was done, it was just wonderful to have done it and go, okay, I'm not going to do that again. Because a lot of people have said, you should do that again. It's an amazing show. I just can't go back there. It was a roller coaster, but it was a great thing to do for me and for others who watched it. And also for Louis to see his experience on stage, and he was represented by a Man United pillow, and that was how that was him. And it was funny, and it was, and also in the show I was really, wow, that again plumbed the depths of being brave and being ugly.
Yeah,
there were some very good bits of physical comedy and sort of physical tragedy in that as well. You know, I had to represent all the characters. So I was playing like about 15 or 20 different people, all the nurses. I was playing myself when I went mad, drinking too much, you know, whatever I was doing afterwards. Yeah, so it was, again, just what happened in the moment. I had to write it. And I suppose the books have been a bit the same. I felt it was time to write it. And, yeah, when you said, have you enjoyed it? I haven't really enjoyed it. The last year has been painful because I write longhand, so
I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah, that's been hellish because any changes have to be done in longhand. So at some points I was like screenshotting my handwriting and sending it to my editor. It was a process. Poor woman, she finally came to my house and just sat next to me on a computer to get some of the changes in, because it was no mean feat. I've been carrying it around in my bag. bag in a big file for about 3 years. That's really great.
I can't believe that. I had to write a note in a birthday card the other day and it hurt my hands right for that long because I just don't do it anymore. I just don't.
Yeah, we've lost our ability. We don't know what our handwriting looks like. And I think that's really sad.
Yeah, I agree. I should try and do it more often. Here's something else that a woman shouldn't be doing, and that is old.
Oh, yes.
Have work to keep working.
That was what someone who'd had a facelift said to me. Have work to keep working. That kind of says it all about what's happening to women and their faces in the business and in the world. I just campaign really vehemently to try and get especially young women to not hate themselves, not hate their faces or their bodies. It's really tough.
Yeah.
It's really tough. It's been a real epidemic. All the aesthetic clinics that are everywhere, I'm constantly graffitiing those with my Sharpie pen. And it's just, it's where we are. We're in a really sort of ugly place where it's become very normal to do that. We don't have enough older, aging women on screen who haven't had work, who look like themselves, playing feisty characters, playing the characters that we all are at the stage, you know, a whole range of different types of people, like at any age.
Yeah.
We don't see the older actors. In fact, I'm about to do a play in the West End, which is about this very issue. And it's great. The new play called Leoness by Penelope Skinner. And it's got Kristen Scott Thomas playing the lead. And it's about an aging actress. And it's a fabulous play. And it's a kind of Me Too play as well. Yeah, come and see it. Get everyone to come and see it.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Actually, yeah. There is other stuff that I wanted to talk to you about that you've got coming out, but I'm not going to be able to because of the actor strike.
Oh, God. Okay. Yeah. Oh, right. We're not allowed to talk about that. That's right.
That is a shame. I also wanted to talk to you about something that you did a documentary for Radio 4, and this is another issue that you are absolutely on it, and it is an evergreen topic for Standard Issue. We talk about it all the time. Which is your documentary Body Count Rising, which is about naked, dead, murdered women on television.
Yeah.
Well done.
Thank you.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
When I was shooting something called Plebs, which is a kind of Boise show that I was just doing a sort of little part, and there were two women in it. Two young women, and both the young women had done rape stories in their careers. And we started having this big conversation about rape as entertainment and how many shows had violence against women in it. And I just became so incensed. It was like I'd reached saturation point of hearing these stories. So I wrote an article and sent it to my friend, and she put it on Twitter, and it kind of went viral, and the New Statesman published it. And it was called Enough is Enough. And then on the strength of that, because I'm not on any social media, the feeling, but to read the comments, you know, people were sending me, and I realised how much support there was for this issue. Because within my business, it's people don't want to speak up about it because they don't want to not work. And they find themselves in shows where there is a rape, and they're like, oh, dude, I'm not sure. I haven't worked for 2 years. And I'd be like, well, I would encourage you not to be in that show. But it's really hard.
Yeah.
Because people can make their own decisions. So then a producer approached me from the Beeb and said, do you want to turn this article kind of more into a documentary about dead, chased, murdered, raped, violence against women in entertainment, in our media, stories that we're watching? So we just went and did a lot of research and talked to the people on the shows that we didn't like, that we found were giving mixed messages, that were, you know, titillating for the wrong sort of reasons. And it was interesting because there's an actress called Amanda Burton who's in Silent Witness, who was.
Yeah.
That's her job. That's what she did for years. That made her name. So we had a kind of interesting discussion about that, but she didn't agree with me. So there's lots of people who aren't going to agree with my take on why I think we should like literally have sort of zero tolerance for these stories. I think they're invading our culture and making it more dangerous for women and also igniting more and more misogyny around an already very misogynistic world. So, yeah, I'd love people to hear it and also to not watch those programs because then you become part of the ratings. And it's interesting because after the show, people are like, oh, I was watching this program and I was suddenly thinking, why am I watching this? I feel really deflated, really horrible after it. Why am I watching this thriller that women are dead and on slabs? And so yeah. Sort of when you realize what you're watching, you think, why am I watching that? What good does that do me? Yeah. I love it. We all love a thriller. I love a thriller, but I now cannot watch anything that has any violence against women in it. I just can't. I just literally turn off.
I can't not ask you about Pedogeddon, because that's such an interesting cultural touch point. For anyone who doesn't know what that is, it's an episode of Brass Eye, which caused the Daily Mail to absolutely melt down and go on quite the campaign against everyone involved in it, including you and Chris Morris and Amadou Iannucci. Do you think it would be made now? Do you think anything like that would ever be made again?
Interesting, isn't it? I don't think it would necessarily be made now. We were protesting about the kind of really vigilante culture we were in that moment.
Yeah.
Which really was, there's a pedo in every corner. I remember I had two small kids. People wouldn't let their kids run off and go and play in the woods where they couldn't see them. Or it was like, you can't let your kid out of your sight because there's a man on a bench over there. It was responding to that, and also Crime Watch and the sort of weird mix of the way things were reported with the kind of sexual overtones and all quite sexy, like crime porn, basically. I don't know if it would be. It would be, you know, I don't think there is really hard-hitting satire on at the moment anywhere. Do you? I mean, have you watched any? I'm not a big telly watcher, so.
I don't think there is much hard-hitting satire, to be honest. And actually, if anything, I think fear of paedophilia has actually probably worsened over the last 20-odd years with, you know, things like the Savile crisis and at the BBC. And I think everyone's...
Yeah.
Really. I mean, it was Channel 4. The BBC would never have put it on in the first place, I don't think. But yeah, I don't know. I think people are more... I think because of social media, broadcasters are more sensitive to offending people because they know that a mob can be whipped up on social media at a moment's notice to comply.
Yeah, in a way, the mob is social media now, as in the old... Yeah, exactly. They're their own court.
Dune, My Lady Parts, out on the 21st of September. You're going to go off and do your recording of the audiobook, which I'm sure will be excellent. Good luck with that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Been lovely talking to you from my podcast number two, please.
Yeah, it has been great. Thank you so much.
Standard issue for all women.